Hey.
What's going on, everybody? AJ Capasso here with Crime Documentaries. How's it going, my friend?
Yeah, it's been one of those days.
Hey, yeah. For once. I like this.
Yeah, it's been one of those days. Yeah, that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I get that, what I was telling you about, that interesting email I got. And, yeah. Should I share or should I not share?
If you're allowed to.
So as a lot of you know, I got a movie role, which is great. And it's been a while since I've had anything. So, and you saw the audition.
Yeah.
I showed you the audition.
I loved it. Yeah.
And so it was definitely different. So I get an email probably 10 minutes before the show started. About quarter to, somewhere in there. And so I didn't read it. And then I go, oh, shit, that email came in. So let me read that, because there was a few. It was before I was coming up to the back room with you guys. And so I read the email and I go, really? So not to get too deep into what my role is, because I really can't talk about it. But I will say there's a particular scene, not with me. There's a particular scene that's going to be with two people. So they asked me if I'm okay with it and if I had any issues with it, because unfortunately when this scene happens, it's going to be a closed set and it's only going to be cast and crew in the room. There won't be anybody else allowed in the room. So,
yeah.
Because a lot of times you can have producers in there, executive producers, you know, a lot of people that's on the crew, and like you know, people that help or whatever, change the camera lens, those people are not going to be allowed in the room. So it should be interesting, but I've never ever received an email like that. And
interesting.
Yeah, if I felt comfortable with it. Now, just to let people know, they are going to be in their, you know, underwear, but
it's going to be interesting.
It should be interesting. I haven't gotten the script yet, so I can't wait to see what the script has to say.
And, oh, geez.
Yeah. And, yeah, well, it's just funny. Right? Funny that, yeah. Funny that. And, you know, something I find interesting that I see a lot, and it has nothing to do with this, but something to do with this, but not.
Yeah.
A lot of emails I'm getting now, have you noticed that people are putting in their pronouns in their emails now?
Yes, I have noticed that. And I didn't understand it too much, but I'm like, I understand it now, obviously, because we're 2024 and I get it. But I was a little confused in some emails that I have gotten recently. And I'm just like, why did that matter? I don't understand. But I mean, hey, whatever works, you know, I'm cool with it, whatever. But I was a little thrown off myself. But hey, I was cool with it.
So should I have pronouns? Should you have pronouns? Do you have pronouns?
Listen, I just go by it. That's okay. It.
Yeah, I'm sticking to kind of the same thing.
Yeah, that's it.
But you know. Yeah, so it was definitely, I will say it was definitely an interesting email. But, you know, on top of that, I liked her role is support cast, which I've never seen. Support cast, and I guess this particular scene. But it's interesting. I've never seen that before. And so this should be an interesting movie. I'm not going to give away the title because the title's horrible. I hope they change the name. The title's not bad. I shouldn't say it's horrible, but it can be worked upon.
Can be worked on.
But but it should be interesting. I'm looking forward to this film to see what it's because I've never really done a movie. Like, I've done a movie before, but not to this caliber.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it should be interesting. So
that is definitely going to be something unique. I can't wait to hear from you after it, because it's going to be the funniest talk that I'm ever going to have with you. It's going to be great. It's going to be absolutely great. But the imagery,
I'm not going to get too descriptive, but because really, I can't really. You're not really supposed to talk about the movie and stuff.
Of course,
but obviously, I'm not talking about the movie. Maybe just that scene, but. You know, other than that, we'll see. But what's been going on with you?
Not much, my friend. I'm excited for today's show.
Yeah, me too.
Home. We have Inside the Criminal Mind. I'm so excited for this episode. We have someone very important in back that I'm looking forward to bring forward. Should we bring him forward now? All right. His name is Ben Cotterill, and I wanted to bring him forward. He is a forensic psychologist, and I wanted to bring him forward. So let's bring him up right now. Hey, Ben, how are you, my friend?
Good. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
No, thank you for coming. We really appreciate it. Sorry, I had to listen to our little spiel in the beginning again. But, you know,
isn't it weird? It's a little weird, isn't it?
It's very interesting.
Yeah. Very interesting. I in that particular circumstance when you're filming, like as a person that's going to be, you know, obviously watching it and you know, doing what I'm doing, but like, where do you put your hands? Like, like you do this or like, I have no idea, but it's going to be different. But I want to say thank you for coming on today's show as well. I'm definitely, when AJ was telling me that you were coming on, I was definitely intrigued by what you do. So I'm looking forward to talking to you today and learning more about you and what you do and what it entails, your job. It sounds very, very interesting. Is it more glamorous than it really is?
I would say it's less glamorous than people think it is.
Okay. I guess that's kind of what I meant, but yeah. when people say you're a forensic psychologist, it's like, wow, that sounds really, really cool. And yeah.
I mean, the majority of forensic psychologists work within prisons, you know, doing maybe risk assessments, rehabilitation work. You know, I did some experience of this during grad school, but realized pretty quickly that working in a prison is actually quite a depressing place. It's not, you know, it's not exactly the kind of thing that you might imagine. But forensic psychology is so broad. It's, you know, how psychology can help with the legal system in so many different forms. So I ended up going into research and teaching academics, which I've ended up loving.
Cool.
I was just about to say, what motivated you to get into forensic psychology?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to kind of point to that exactly, but I guess even when I was young, I was interested in questions to do with the topic, even before I knew what the topic was, like, you know, what makes people different? You know, why do people do the things that they do? Even as a kid, you know, I was always fascinated by the villains and stories over, you know, what makes someone kind of go to that side and what makes, you know, kind of what motivates them. So, you know, I never really had like a plan to end up here. I just kind of took things one step at a time and followed what I was interested in. And, you know, this is where it's led.
So, did you start doing it when you moved here to the States, or were you doing it in Scotland as well?
So I did my master's in forensic psychology. So that's when I got some hands-on experience. And then I did my PhD research in Scotland, which was mainly about understanding children as witnesses, how reliable they are. So some of the questions I wanted to answer is, you know, if a child witnesses a crime, how do police most effectively interview them? What's the kind of questions that they should ask? And what's the best formats to follow? You know, does the child's personality have an influence on the police interview? How does the child come across to a jury if they're then giving testimony in a trial? So that's kind of where my research mainly focused. And I did do some teaching also in the UK. And then, yes, I moved to the States 2.5 years ago to start a course on forensic psychology at Clemson in South Carolina. So it was kind of starting that course from scratch based upon what I had learned from being in the UK. And then again, it's, you know, it's a broad subject that introduces the students, you know, to all kind of areas of forensic psychology. So how psychology can help understand, you know, the memory of witnesses, how juries come to their decisions, and what causes criminal behavior, and all these other different, you know, fields, false confessions, profiling.
Yeah, it's interesting. And like we're on our second season right now. And, you know, we've done a lot of shows on, you know, criminals and mainly killers, people that have the worst of the worst. And we're, you know, I always make a joke at the beginning that here's another crazy one, you know, because sometimes that's how we look at them, right? That's them being crazy. And it's interesting that you said that, looking at the background and looking at the mind and stuff like that. And, you know, I think we all have our own opinions on why a killer is a killer. And I know there's a lot of scientific reasons behind it too, because there's something in the brain that's missing that everybody else has. Maybe you can go into a little more depth on what makes a killer. And I know that's a real, you know, broad question, but I'm sure it's a question that a lot of people want to know, because obviously, again, we've done a lot of shows on killers, and they seem like extraordinary people, like really, really nice people. But then there's a side of them. It's like, you know, a Jekyll and Hyde kind of type of thing. Right. And so if you could answer that, I know that's a real broad question, but maybe we can narrow it down just a little bit as you're explaining it.
Okay. It's a really interesting question. And actually, this previous academic year, I've been teaching a kind of new course. It's a senior level advanced seminar on the neuropsychology of criminal behavior. And it's answering that very question, what causes someone to be criminal? So it's looking at the biological factors, the social factors, how they interact, because almost in all cases, both factors are present or pushing the behavior, both biology and social factors. In terms of how the brain fits into this, that's a part I'm really interested in. Adrian Raine, I was lucky enough to have as a mentor during my grad school, and he's the main figurehead in terms of the neuropsychology of criminal behavior. And the course I teach is really summing up the research that's been done by him and his lab and his grad students. So for example, the very first ever neuroimaging study on criminals was done by Adrian Raine in the mid 90s at San Quentin prison in California.
Okay.
And what he unearthed in that study was the role of the prefrontal cortex, and it's a finding that's been found again and again. So the prefrontal cortex is the kind of outer layer of the frontal lobe. So it's, you know, this kind of part of the front of your head. Mm. And what he found was in the killers, it was dysfunctional. It wasn't activating in the same way for them as it would for most people. Now, that's not too surprising, because the prefrontal cortex is involved in so many executive functions, so impulse control, your ability to make good decisions and plan ahead, your ability to take on the perspective of others, so to have empathy. But one of these killers was not like the others. One of the killers in this sample was Randy Kraft, also known as the scorecard killer, who killed about 66 people over a 12-year period.
Oh, wow.
And he had excellent prefrontal cortex functioning. And that, again, isn't too surprising, because most of these killers, they killed once and then were caught. And the crime that they committed was haphazard. It was disorganized. You know, it was in a robbery. It was in an argument. It was kind of unplanned in the heat of the moment. But for Randy Kraft, you know, you have to have certain cognitive abilities to get away with that many crimes over such a long period of time, beyond, you know, what the typical offender has. And he had, you know, excellent IQ as well, whereas the other offenders were below average IQ. They were very impulsive.
Yeah.
But you know, this gave Adrian Raine the idea, actually, that if he split killers into those that were reactive, so those that killed when the event was unplanned, you know, it was haphazard again, it was disorganized, versus those that were more predatory in nature, those that were calculating and planned out the crime, this dysfunction would only be found in the disorganized reactive killers. And that's what he found. So to explain what's different in the more predatory killers, he had to go a bit deeper to some more subcortical regions. So this is really where psychopathy comes into it, which is, you know, a personality disorder. It's an extreme personality disorder that's found in kind of the worst of the worst offenders. It's one of the best predictors for reoffending and for violence. And so some of the things that were different within this group, these more psychopathic offenders like Randy Kraft and Ted Bundy, who, you know, are able to come across normal and charming, even though they have these more sinister intentions. Some of the things that were different there were two main parts of the brain. One is the striatum, which is the part of the brain that's involved in the reward circuit, so encouraging you to go after what you want, producing dopamine in response to incentive rewards, encouraging you to go after what you want. And these more psychopathic individuals, they have a larger striatum on average than the typical person, and a more hypersensitive to rewards striatum as well than the average person. So that was one major brain difference. And then the other was the amygdala, which is the kind of center point for emotion. So, you know, there's many parts of the brain involved in emotion, but if you thought of it as an orchestra, then, you know, the amygdala is the conductor. It's the crucial component. And it's also involved in fear conditioning. So, you know, the pairing of stimuli so that you learn from mistakes and you fear consequences in the future, right? If you were told off and punished for stealing when you were a child, and then later on, when you thought about stealing, you got a sense of fear that's telling you that the amygdala is well working. If we remove the amygdala from animals like race monkeys, they can no longer learn fear. And the amygdala is smaller, you know, 18% on average smaller in psychopaths, and it's less active as well.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of curious. Is it because of the frontal and it being confused, or, you know, being how did you say it's mixed up or whatever? Is there something else in the brain that's heightened because of that? Like, that is, there's something wrong with that, but there's something else that's really heightened. Could that be the IQ? Could that be, you know, could it be something else? Like, have they discovered that?
Yeah, so in these reactive killers who had this prefrontal cortex dysfunction.
Dysfunction, that's what I meant. Thank you.
Yeah, they actually have very quite hyperactive subcortical regions that are involved in emotion. So the amygdala in this group is actually quite hypersensitive to threats, especially. The hypothalamus and the thalamus, which are involved in the aggression network, they're even more active than in the typical person. So, you know, these parts of the brain are involved in more animalistic behaviors, your basic emotions, your basic urges. And then the prefrontal cortex is that which keeps a lid on bad behavior, right? The more animalistic behavior, it's controlling your impulses and so on. It's the more sophisticated part of the brain. So for these reactive offenders, you know, they have these hyperactive or hypersensitivities, these, you know, hot emotions, but they don't have this lid on the emotions. So the emotions just run wild and will control their behavior.
Wow. That's very interesting. I never even thought of it like that. I knew that about the amygdala, a little bit about it. And I knew the prefrontal cortex did play a kind of a role in some of these killers, because some of the killers that we have reviewed on this podcast, some of them had amazing IQs, and some of them, like, literally were the smartest people, in my opinion, that I've ever witnessed. They just chose a path that obviously wasn't the right path, you know, due to probably issues along these lines. But to see someone with such intelligence and then go down a route like that is just like, you know, wow, you know, like, there had to be something behind it. It's amazing that forensic psychology has been able to, you know, figure some of it out, to figure out what is really going on inside the brain.
And certainly the environment plays a large role as well, right? Because what we find is in studies, quite often there has to be a pairing of both environmental factors and biological factors for there to really be an increased risk of violence. You know, so some of these biological predispositions, if they're paired with good environments, you know, they don't produce these bad behaviors. You know, there's some people who have a predisposition for fearlessness. They have low levels of arousal, they have low resting heart rates, you know, and yes, that can be a push towards criminal behavior because you don't fear consequences. And it could also be a push towards a more pro-social job, like a bomb diffuser or a fireman or someone who, you know, is courageous in some way. So it's the environment that really, you know, seems to kind of tilt one person one way or the other.
Yeah, it's interesting because AJ, it's interesting because we've talked about, we had somebody on the show or we talked about because normally what we do, we have documentaries that we show on the show. And we had one guy here in Canada. He was I can't even recall his Bruce. What was his name? Bruce.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I can't think of his last name.
He was Bruce. I can't recall his last name, but he was, and you might've heard of this guy. It was very popular several years ago. He was killing gay people in the gay community. And, he was actually gay himself. But he was a very, very smart, intelligent man. But then on the flip side of that, there was another person here in Toronto that rented a van and killed 18 people down Yonge Street, just driving down the street, killing 18 people. Now, the reason I bring that up is because the gym that I went to this gym, and there was a correctional officer that worked at that jail. And he was saying the guy that Bruce was an extremely, extremely intelligent man. His IQ was very, very high. But the guy that did the killing of the 18 people and just drove down the street in a van, his IQ level is below average. And it's just really interesting, the two different spectrums. You have this one brilliant man and then you have one guy, but they both did the same thing by killing people, but one was more on an impulse and one was more planned out. And it, you know, I did private investigation for 6 years and I always ask people, what do you think is worse, theft or fraud? And people would always say theft. Well, it's not the case. It's fraud, because fraud is something you plan out. Theft is an impulse. And it's almost like in this circumstance here that with Bruce and this other guy and you just talking about all that stuff, I find it really fascinating. You know, people that kill people could be so different, but so much the same too. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I mean, that was one of the kind of earliest distinctions by the FBI, right? When they first began interviewing serial killers, they observed that, you know, some were organized in how they committed their crimes. Some were more disorganized. And there was a lot of commonalities. Those who were more organized, they did have higher IQs and they were able to hold down jobs and they were able to have relationships and so on. So they were organized in all facets of their lives. Whereas those who were more disorganized in how they committed the crimes, they had lower IQs. They, you know, they couldn't hold down a job. They couldn't appear normal to neighbors. They couldn't have relationships. They were disorganized in all facets of life. And we've, you know, moved beyond that, but we've also kind of added to it as well in terms of, you know, what's some of the underlying differences between those who are more organized versus those disorganized.
Yeah. And it's just, it's interesting because these two people that I talked about are who you're talking about right now, you know? Yes, yeah. And it's amazing how, you know, how that works. And anyways, AJ.
No, what I wanted to actually ask was, what methods and tools would you use for psychological assessments in forensic psychology settings, like, or in forensic settings? Like, what kind of tools and assessments would you use for, say, dealing with these type of criminals or dealing with, you know, children as witnesses and stuff like that? What kind of assessments would you use and tools?
Yeah, so, I mean, risk assessing is one of the most frequent jobs a forensic psychologist will do if they work in a prison setting. So that's assessing their level of risk for reoffending, and then that will help inform parole decisions and so on, you know, which ones are at higher risk of reoffending, those who are lower. So we have pretty well validated risk assessments for helping us with these. Some that assess level of risk for particularly sexual offenders, some for violent offenders more broadly. The psychopathy checklist is a risk assessment tool I know the most about, because psychopathy is one of my main areas of interest. So the psychopathy checklist, it looks for 20 different psychopathic characteristics. So manipulation, pathological lying, early evidence of a conduct disorder, you know, all these other indicators of psychopathy. And that's one tool for measuring level of risk. It measures how psychopathic one is. And psychopathy is one of the kind of best predictors of reoffending. So it has, especially in the US, it has quite large implications. You know, the rest of one's life could be decided based upon how high they score on the psychopathy checklist, because they're less likely, according to research, to rehabilitate. They're more likely to reoffend, so they're more of a danger to the public. So in the US, if you score higher in the psychopathy checklist, you're more likely to get the death penalty, you're less likely to get parole, you're more likely to get a longer sentence. You know, in the US, has quite a large number of implications.
Wow.
So for somebody that you think is good, let me ask you this way. How do you determine if somebody's going to reoffend or going to go out there and be, a perfect citizen? How is that determined? Because I'm kind of curious. And the only reason why I say that is because of the fact that, you can answer that question. And because there's something else I want to bring up, because there's something that we've talked about on the show many, many times, and I'm very curious about. So how do you determine if somebody's going to reoffend or not?
So forensic psychologists used to be terrible at gauging who's going to reoffend and who's not. We've certainly got a lot better as the tools have been more tested and more validated. Obviously, it's still not perfect, but the psychopathy checklist, for example, has pretty good reliability. So meaning that if multiple forensic psychologists evaluate the same person, their scores are pretty much in agreement. So, you know, for the psychopathy checklist, you would interview the person for several hours, use their background information, and then you would score how highly they score on each of these psychopathy indicators. And then the idea is that those who score higher are more likely to reoffend, and so they would be less likely to get parole and so on. So we have better tools for being able to predict this, you know, better than we used to be able to, but of course it's never going to be perfect because it's still somewhat of a subjective evaluation.
Yeah, and you know, like I was saying before, like we always talk about this on the show, and like people are always reading these type of things on why killers kill or why killers, you know, kill, or why do some killers, you know, it's sexual offenses and stuff like that. But something that we've always talked about on this show is something that always seems to be a little bit of a pattern, that men that have been sexually abused by their fathers are more on the violent side of things. But if a man has been sexually abused by a mother, it's more, maybe not sexual abuse, maybe, you know, I don't know. What would you say, AJ?
Like beating,
like whatever, like a guy that's been abused by his father is more abusive towards other people. A man that's been sexually abused by his mother is more on the sexual side of things. Is there any kind of truth to that? Because we always kind of hear that kind of stuff. So, and we've talked about it a lot on this show, actually. So did that question make any sense whatsoever? Like, it was kind of all over the place.
Yeah, I don't know so much about that distinction. I mean, I know having been abused as a child is a risk factor for being more likely to sexually offend and so on when one is older. It's a fairly small effect. Correlation is about 0.15. So it's significant, but it's fairly small.
Yeah.
In regard to what you were saying with relationships with mothers, you know, linking back to what you were saying before about serial killers, you know, that's been one of the kind of common factors found to serial killers, right? That so many of them do have these majorly extreme mother issues that they were, you know, Henry Lee Lucas, for example, was tormented viciously by his mother. Edmund Kemper killed his mother before turning himself in. And there's multiple examples. And in many cases, the victims of serial killers seem to be surrogates for their mother. The mother is the real target of their rage.
Yeah.
And in many of those cases, the father wasn't present.
Yeah, but is there any kind of truth to the fact that if a father has been present and he was physically abusive towards his son, the son will be more violent rather than more on the sexual side if he ends up being, you know, a killer or whatever? Like, for example, like if the mother is more on the sexual side of things, they say he's more unlikely, and I hate to use this word, and I'm sorry, people that are listening, end up being rapists. And, you know, is there any correlation to that at all? Because I know we hear all the time that, you know, this guy ended up being very violent towards people because his father was very violent towards him. You know, so I don't know, like listening to what you said earlier, I don't know if there it would make sense because of that part of the brain, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I say, more kind of more broadly, there is this association between having been abused and then maybe being abusive once one's older. I don't really know about the distinction you're making. I guess always assumed that, you know, the type of abuse that one would commit would be similar to the abuse they suffered themselves, that they're kind of, you know, learning from their own environment.
Yeah, because you always hear of some, like, look at Jeffrey Dahmer. He started off by, you know, killing animals. And but apparently his father was a very abusive man. And his mother was a very I forget what his mother had something to do with it, but I think she was it was almost like she was an enabler kind of type of person. Like if he did something wrong, Jeffrey could do no wrong. But in his father's eyes, he did everything wrong. And I think psychologically that damaged him.
I mean, Jeffrey Dahmer is an interesting case. His mother was severely depressed. His father was very cold and absent. And he did have that kind of, you know, stuffing of dead animals as a kind of way of bonding with his father. There's a really interesting paper by Aliel and colleagues, and they looked at over 200 cases of serial killers and try to narrow down what were the most common findings across their backgrounds. And they settled on three. One is some major trauma in their early development or some disruption to social development. So Jeffrey Dahmer is one of the examples in the paper, and they kind of talk about some of the factors that we talked about. Richard Ramirez, the night stalker, is another example in the paper. You know, when he was a child, he witnessed his cousin murder his wife. That same cousin used to tell him stories about women in Vietnam he had raped and tortured and killed. You know, his older cousin was basically a serial killer himself, but had managed to get away with it because the crimes were overseas. And he had to take pictures also that he took of, you know, the horrible things he did to these women in Vietnam. And he would show them to Richard Ramirez when he was a child. So there's, you know, Henry Lee Lucas was tormented by his mother, right? She dressed him as a girl to humiliate him. She killed this donkey that he liked in a nearby field just to upset him. She would frequently beat him once so bad that he was in a coma for several days. So, you know, the major trauma is evident in so many of these cases. So that's one of the factors that the paper outlines. The second one is some head trauma early in childhood. So again, it's surprising just how many of these cases have evidence of hospitalization early on for some blow to the head. So again, there's overlap here because quite often it's as a consequence of physical abuse.
Yeah, it's interesting because we another, just going back on past stories that we've done, we did Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, and both of them were raised with within great families. I understand, they Carla's parents were very loving, Paul Bernardo's parents were very loving, but that itself, have you studied that at all? Have you read up about that at all? Because I find it really, really interesting that these two had beautiful families that loved them mm-hmm. dearly, and they still did what they did. Paul Bernardo, and I'll be honest, I think Carla was worse than Paul. I think Paul followed Carla, to be honest, and it wasn't the other way around. I think she was the lead in all of that. But again, they came from perfect families.
And yeah, I mean, those cases are interesting. In those cases, we have to look more to biological factors, right, rather than social factors. There's been a number of school shooters as well. Eric Harris from the Columbine case, Andrew Golden. You know, they came from good families. You know, they were middle class, educated homes. You know, Eric's older brother was a star athlete, and you know, their siblings all turned out, you know, to be upstanding citizens. Certainly no abuse or anything in their background. So in those sorts of cases, we have to assume that biology plays more of a role, either in the form of mental illness. So it could be, you know, some paranoid schizophrenia disorder that might make them more delusional. Or it could be some of the kind of brain abnormalities I talked about before that leads one to being more psychopathic. And those sorts of cases.
That's a hard word. It's a real hard word to say, psychopathic, right? Like that's something that's got to be something really, really extreme to go to that level when you're saying this person is psychopathic. Like that is just, to me, that is just and I'm sorry, and I know it's part of your field and stuff like that, but to me, that's just a horrible, horrible word. And when I think of psychopathic, I think of like a horror film of somebody going around like a Jason killing a bunch of people for, you know, because he didn't like them in his cabin, you know, or something like that. It's just, you know, it's just, to me, psychopathic is just an awful, awful word. And, you know, one thing that I've discovered, sorry, AJ, I'll let you get to your question. I just want to say this, but one thing I've discovered recently, and I'm sure that's, I don't know if this part of your field at all, and it might be, but one thing I've noticed in today's world that, that doctors seem to be diagnosing bipolar like that, and to the blame of a lot of different issues that people are having, and why people do certain things is because of this bipolar, and you know, and they're given drugs and all this stuff, they're basically tossed aside. And do you ever find that in your field, that like with some doctors, they're saying, well, this person's psychopathic, but then you look at it and go, no, that's not what's going on at all here. You know, have you ever encountered that kind of stuff?
I don't know about that for sure. I know the field is moving more and more away from these kind of categorization approaches to more trying to look at maladaptive traits and trying to look at, you know, things on a spectrum. Trying to move more and more in that direction. So that's kind of helping maybe with some of those overdiagnoses and kind of trying to stop us from simplifying things too much, right? By just putting a label on it and saying it's because of this disorder.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you what, in ethical and legal considerations, what ethical dilemmas are common in forensic psychology? And like, how would you address them, or how do you address them?
So ethical dilemmas, you mean, I guess, the fact that we're dealing with pretty vulnerable people, you know, the population. I mean, for me, I guess most of my research has been interviewing child witnesses.
It must take a toll on you. I mean, dealing with children like that have gone through such horrific things. I mean, does it take a toll on yourself dealing with, you know, children and stuff like that?
Yes, no, yeah, of course, especially with children, because the kind of crimes you're talking about are, you know, pretty horrific. I guess with the ethical side of things, you know, in kind of research I've done when studying children's memory, it's, you know, about trying not to traumatize them, right? So the kind of studies I've done have been having children, for example, watch a crime, but it's a non-violent crime, like the one child stealing another child's bike. And then you interview them in the same way a police officer would, you know, following the same interview schedule. And again, just careful to make sure that, you know, they're happy to take part and that everything's not really at the extreme.
So what do you do if you have a child that doesn't want to do anything, but it's vital to whatever the circumstance may be? How do you deal with that?
I mean, so in a real case, you know, it's really, really difficult, especially with very, very young children who maybe don't really understand, you know, what's really being asked of them, who are maybe very hyperactive, distracted, easily distracted. And in those cases, it's about police trying to be, you know, as patient as they can, trying to build rapport with the child to make the child feel comfortable opening up to them, you know, maybe play a little with the child so the child's, you know, happier in the environment that they're in. But it's incredibly difficult for police, and that's when they often, you know, then kind of go into the realm of using improper questions. You know, maybe they get frustrated and then begin asking leading questions and try to coax the child too much, try to push the child too much into a certain direction. And you know, why in psychology we study children's memory so much is because there's been so many cases of police incorrectly coaxing children into making false accusations and then people going to prison based upon the words of a child, even though they were coaxed words, you know, through leading questions from police. But it's very difficult. I was asked by the public defender's office in Georgia not too long ago to look at police interviews with a child, and the child was only 2 years old when this crime happened. So you can imagine that's a very, very difficult interview to do with a child that young. The child doesn't really, you know, understand the situation, and they're not wanting to sit still in the chair in the police interview. You know, they're very active and easily distracted and want to play with things in the room. So trying to keep that child's attention on the topic at hand is extremely difficult. But we do have guidelines now for police, you know, that keep the interview structured, that, you know, tell the police, you know, how to build rapport, what questions to ask, when to take breaks, you know, exactly how to conduct the interview. And these have been well tested so that we know, you know, this is the best way we know of getting the most reliable, correct responses from the child, most coherent responses from the child, but obviously with many challenges.
I can't even imagine what, you know, I can't even imagine like a 2 year old going through a trauma. And I obviously we know it happens, but just a 2 year old going through, I don't know what happened, but obviously something very, very devastating for the child, and a 2 year old child to witness that is obviously going to be affected the rest of their lives because of it. If they, you know, and obviously 2 years old, they might forget it as they get older, but there's going to be some underlying. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, the, I mean, the legal proceedings could kind of make it worse though and guarantee that they will remember it. Right. So I'm thinking of another case, this time from Scotland. The child was 4 years old, I believe maybe three or four when the crime happened. They would have had a chance probably to forget about it, right? But then they're being interviewed by police over the course of a year. The following year, they're giving testimony in trial. 2 years after that, they're giving testimony in an appeal by the defendant. You know, by this point, it's becoming more and more ingrained, right? It's going to be now a permanent part of their autobiographical memory. So the legal proceeding, you know, can take a real toll on the children.
Oh yeah, never even thought about that. Yeah, never even thought about that. Wow.
Now, kind of going back to what we were talking before we started talking about the children, I wanted to ask this question. I wanted to ask, what are like some unique challenges when you're working with individuals who do have severe mental illnesses? Like what are some unique challenges like when working with these type of offenders?
I mean, with offenders, it's going to come with difficulties in the rehabilitation process, right? Because a big part of the rehabilitation process is helping with empathy training, helping with anger and control, anger management, you know, being able to take on the perspective of others. But if they have impaired abilities, right, that, you know, might hinder the kind of training in those areas, it could make empathy training even more difficult, anger management even more difficult if they're incredibly impulsive and prone to acting on their emotions. So it can just make the process, you know, more difficult. But again, there are some kind of more specialized treatments and, you know, some instructors who are more specialized with those types of offenders to help the rehabilitation process be as effective as possible. But yeah, again, it's going to come with unique challenges.
Is there any worry when working with children like that, going through like a child that had to go through such that process for so many years and getting it ingrained in their head? Is there any worry that these children may come out with a mental illness of their own, like maybe when they get older, because of the trauma and what they have to experience throughout the court proceedings, throughout the everything? Is that something that you may worry about for them?
Yeah, I mean, it could lead to, you know, anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress. Yeah, any of these are real concerns, you know, with any victim, especially to, you know, a sexual assault or any kind of violent crime. But I would probably say even more so, at least to a large extent with children. Yeah.
Right. So you probably get this question a lot, but if somebody wanted to pursue a career in your field, how would they go about doing that? Because I'm sure there are people that are going to be listening through the podcast and watching the podcast that are going, you know what, this is something that I'm really intrigues me and I'm interested in pursue it. How would they do that?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, master's programs in forensic psychology, so you can get that education. I would also say it's really important to get some experience in the field. You know, it could be small experience. It could be, you know, volunteering when you can, so that you're, you know, interacting with a relevant population, right? So it could be giving support to witnesses for courts. It could be, I myself, as a grad student, volunteered for a restorative justice charity, which is about if victims to a crime or the families of a victim want to reach out to an offender with particular questions, and then helping facilitate that, you know, helping manage expectations and helping maybe with writing letters or setting up a meeting. So looking for any kind of charities like that, that, you know, actually deal with prison populations or victims. If you're able to, you know, maybe shadow a forensic psychologist or, you know, gain some experience in the environment, you know, because it's one thing to, you know, think that I want to go into this field. It's another thing to then actually get the experience right in the environment and so on. That's then when you actually learn if this is really what you want to go into.
Yeah.
So I would say
it's gotta be tough. It's gotta be a lot of school. A lot of school, I bet. Get used to school. You're on mute, AJ.
Sorry, that actually leads me to another question I wanted to ask was, how do you maintain your work-life balance, you know, given the demands of your profession, like as a forensic psychologist? Like, how do you personally, for yourself, going through school and then now being a professor yourself, like teaching this, how do you maintain, you know, that work-life balance?
I mean, university was full on at times. You know, I had to go through my undergrad and then my master's and my PhD. So, you know, that took up a lot of my time for a long time, you know, especially in grad school. I was, you know, working part-time jobs to help, you know, pay tuition fees and rent and so on as well. Yeah. So, you know, there comes some sacrifice, I guess, of kind of personal life, at least for a period. I would say I'm really lucky with the job I have now. I do have a lot of downtime, really. I don't feel overworked in the job I'm in.
That's great.
I'm actually kind of curious. You talked about kids quite a bit during this time. Have you dealt with any children in any kind of school shooting or anything like that, or any children that you have? You said something about a 2-year-old. Were you dealing with that? Have you dealt with anything with a 2, 4, or 5-year-old that hopefully is going to come out on the better side, hopefully?
No. So in that case, I was just watching after the fact the recorded interviews with police.
Okay.
Writing a report on, you know, what was done correctly and incorrectly in the interview. So I don't have personal experience of interviewing a child who was actually a victim to a crime like that.
Okay.
In my research,
good thing. That's a good thing. To be honest. Yeah.
You know, in the research I do, I want to learn about children's memory abilities, but it's, you know, having them watch videos, for example, like I gave an example of earlier, and then interviewing them on how much they remember after witnessing the video. But, you know, it's all experimental in those sorts of cases.
I'm just sitting here thinking and just, you know, listening to you, and I've listened to you throughout this whole interview, and I'm thinking to myself, how do you deal with this? Seriously, Ben, how do you deal with this on a daily basis? Like, this has got to be mentally draining. Some days it just got to kill you that, you know, you're looking at, you know, for example, these tapes of this cop, you know, this cop interviewing this child. It's got to be mentally draining. Has anybody ever actually asked you, how are you doing?
Yeah. I don't do many cases like that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would really wear you down.
Yeah.
You know, most of my work, I feel, is actually quite academic, and so feel somewhat removed, you know, because it's research and it's teaching. Actually, working in the field, you know, that does take, you know, a lot of resilience and a lot of carefully checking over one's, you know, mental well-being and making sure one has outlets. You know, so when I was a grad student, we had to keep reflective diaries. And if you're a forensic psychologist, you're also supposed to kind of keep this. And it's to kind of, you know, reflect on how you're doing and, you know, what's upsetting you and when you're feeling overstressed and making sure that you're, you know, looking after yourself as well.
I really truly believe that you have to be a special person to be doing this type of work. Like, honestly, and God bless you for, you know, for for what you do in your field. God bless you, because, you know, it's people like you that are helping people, you know, get through this, you know, and, you know, do the right thing, or the cops doing the right thing. And because, let's be honest, you know, in these times, cops are getting more of a, they're getting more, what's the word I'm looking for? They're getting more, they're not looked upon very nicely today, as I think they should be, because the work they do is tough. It's tough work, and I really think you have to be a special person in order to do what you're doing, or, you know, people in the field, talking with these kids or talking with these, you know, offenders, these people in jail. And, you know, it's obviously for a good cause, and I get that. And they're doing it for good reasons, because they want to figure out why people are doing what people are doing. So maybe in some way they can prevent it from happening.
Exactly. And you have to have that kind of motivation.
God bless them. That's all I got to say. God bless you guys for doing it. Even, you know, the guy that we had on last week, the ATF agent, you know, God bless what he does, because you got to be a special person to do that. AJ's aunt in the correctional, she works in the jails. And again, you have to be a special person to be doing that as well, you know, and God bless everybody that is in that area, and for yourself as well. for sure. I just wanted to put that out there. Sorry.
Yeah, no. Thank you, seriously, for your work, honestly. And also, like, what you do now as, you know, a professor and bringing up people that are going into the field, and with your knowledge of what you researched and what you keep researching, you know, just thank you for what you're teaching others from what you've learned, because it's really important.
Exactly.
Thank you very much. I mean, I find that very rewarding. And I guess it's, you know, finding where you fit in. You know, I early on thought maybe I would do work in a prison environment, you know, when I was doing my master's, but I learned quickly that was a bit too much for me. It was quite a depressing environment to be in.
Yeah.
So I think you have to kind of find, you know, where you're suited and where you can fit and where you can kind of help and so on.
Yeah. AJ, is there anything else you want to ask?
I just want to say one last thing. I just want to say thank you, but I also want to say, looking back so far in your career, you have a long career ahead of you, I know that, but looking back on your career as a teacher, just as a student, as everything, what are some of the achievements that you're most proud of? Because you really busted your butt with years of work to get to where you are. So, you know, like he said, God bless you, my friend.
I think just to have ended up in a job that I really do love. You know, I love teaching the students. I feel really, really lucky to, you know, be able to talk about something I'm really interested and fascinated in, and to have students who are really engaged and also really interested in this topic, and to be able to have, you know, productive conversations with them and to be able to share with them what I'm interested in. I feel really, really lucky to have a job like that. And to have came over to the US and then kind of started a course from scratch based upon, you know, what I've learned. You know, that's also been really rewarding, and I could take some pride in that as well.
Yeah, for sure. But I definitely want to thank you for coming on today's show, man. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun learning about you and your career and your background. And obviously forensic psychology is very different. And keep going, man. Keep doing your thing. And are there any books? Are there any books in the works? Because I find forensic psychologists tend to write books. So are you going to be writing a book anytime soon?
I mean, I have some academic books out, but more interestingly, I did actually publish a novel last year. It's a history thriller.
Yeah, I'm not wrong. They always seem to be writing books. And,
hey, I love it.
Yeah, at the end of the day, they're great. A lot of them are great reads. You know, I don't understand half the shit, but, you know, like, but they're all great reads. You know what I mean? And I just find that in that type of field, people tend to write books, and they, for obvious reasons, they write books because they want to get their, you know, what they're doing out there in the world so other people can see it, and maybe other doctors can see it as well and learn from you, and like you're going to be learning from them as well, right? But again, I want to say thank you for coming on today's show. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun getting to know you, and so I'm going to say my goodbyes, AJ.
Yeah, I just want to ask if you would be willing to come back on sometime soon again. There's a couple of things that maybe I would love to go over with you and stuff before
after
you come
your fifth
on.
Book.
Yes, I want, there you go. But also, if you could shout out what your novel was that you did write recently last year, so everyone can, all the viewers can check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to come back. The novel is Nobody in Blackberry Cove. I can send you a link if you like.
Yeah, please. Yeah. And we'll get it up there. We'll get your link up there in the description.
Yeah, and I'll put it in the website too.
And then you can also put it on the VOD or the podcast side as well. Because for some reason our podcast seems to be skyrocketing. I don't know what's going on. It can't be because of me. I'm the dumb one. So
wait, I'm no better here. Hold on, wait.
No, our podcast seems to be skyrocketing for some reason.
Excellent.
And we'll definitely have a lot of listens on the podcast side. So we'll get your link on the podcast so people can go over and get your book if they're interested, for sure. It was great, man. AJ, were you finished or?
I was all set, my friend. Thank you so much, Ben, for coming on. And we will definitely be talking soon. And I'd love to have you on again. So thank you so much.
Great. No, this was a lot of fun. Thank you both. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Have a good night.
Bye.
Oh,
Oh, sorry.
Who's closing him out? You were doing it. I was doing it.
Yeah. I know. We were both doing it. It was all right, though.
I honestly, I'm glad you asked him if you wanted to come back, because I had like 10 other questions that I wanted to ask him. And
oh, I had so many.
I have 10 questions here on my stream.
Look, I got all these on my whole phone. I'm over here getting tons of questions. So I'm like trying to figure out, you know, which ones to throw on. But it's funny because the way that the actual interview went out, it actually went down the line of what I wanted to ask. Just I didn't get to ask every question, but, you know, it went down the line, which was pretty cool. So it actually worked out.
You know, that list that you sent me seems to be working out.
Right?
Yeah.
I told you.
Is there anybody on that list that's actually was a...
criminal? Yes, that's who I'm working on talking to someone who actually is who's second degree murder, who's might be coming on next week. So I didn't want to say anything yet, but yeah, it's a little different side. So I wanted to get somebody with a criminal background, you know, on the show to talk about their life, what they went through, what they dealt with the whole case, and you know, see it from a different point of view, and see, you know, maybe how the viewers react to that type of, you know, content and see what they think.
But, you know, like I was, remember Carmine that we, well, I don't think you were here when, I think I was me and Haley. Yeah, Carmine has a possible person. And if Carmine's watching, I'm sorry, Carmine, then I'm going to say this. If I got this wrong, just, you know, text me and give me shit. he said there was a person that he knows. Remember that case that I was talking about earlier in this interview, that Bruce guy?
Yeah.
He was actually telling me about, remember the last guy that survived?
Yeah.
He was saying that he might be able to hook us up with that guy.
Oh, that'll be amazing.
I don't know if he said that or he said maybe I should reach out. I can't recall. It was a while ago. I got so much going on in my head right now. It's like, it's buzzing. You know what? Ben was great. Yeah. And that, you know, even though he's more on the academic side, he had a lot to say and for obvious reasons, but no, he was great. So I'd like to apologize for not being all here today.
No, you've been fine, my friend. You've been fine. You know, you're going through some things. It's all good, man. Everyone has those days.
You know, I don't know what's going on. It's like, it was like, I woke up this morning and it was like, okay, today's not the day. Today is not the day. And which, to be perfectly honest, I don't have too many of those.
No, that's why I said you shouldn't beat yourself up.
I think it's because you woke me up this morning.
I think it was. I did wake you up this morning because you did go to bed late. I noticed that.
Oh, I went to bed at like, I think I went to bed at like.
I was up at 5. I was up till 5, so I get it.
I went to bed at 4:30, having a little bit of fun last night.
Yeah. You know what I mean? That's why I said I was going to, you know, I'll talk to you later, you know.
Yeah.
Yep.
We didn't say anything.
Thank you guys for tuning in to Inside the Criminal Mind with the forensic psychologist Ben Cotterill. We need to thank
the people on the podcast side.
I was just getting there. Yeah, I wanted to
say they skyrocketed us. They skyrocketed us last week.
They did. They did. And I want to say thank you to everyone who listens on Spotify, Pandora,
iHeartRadio,
any podcast listening platform, you can check us out on right at Crime Documentaries, and also check our YouTube
his email address is talkingwiththesource@gmail.com.
If you forgot
somebody sending an email and give him shit.
Yes, you can email me and give me shit all the time. But yeah, no, if you want to like to be a guest on the show and you have some background in true crime and as in a forensic psychologist or anything like criminal justice, anything like that, please feel free to reach out to us. My email is talkingwiththesource@gmail.com.
In the description.
We'd love to have you on. Definitely.
It's in the description.
Oh, even better. There we go.
Oh, I don't know if it's in the this one because you did this one today.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's right. No worries. So So, he froze on me. Yep, he froze. It's all right. Well, since I'm by myself right at the moment, thank you guys so much for watching. I appreciate everyone for tuning in. Oh, he's back.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm telling you, it's this damn friggin' miner that I have plugged in.
I know.
Yeah. We need an outro.
Well, that's what I'm going to be working on, because I didn't know if we were going to do the Parapost one or whatnot, but we'll figure it out. We'll get it going.
Yeah.
Well, thank
you. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
No, go ahead. Say what you're going to say. I'm just saying good night for me.
Oh, no. I was just going to say thank you, everyone, for tuning in and have a great night.
Okay. There you go. Good night, everyone.
Case closed.
Oh, there you go. We haven't said that in a while.
Right?